Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. A nail-biting first round followed by a close call in the second. The latest Turkish elections did not produce a change in Ankara, but they will certainly be remembered for the ebbs and flows of the electoral process. And with the Turkish domestic status quo holding, what does it mean for the transformation in the larger world? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hasan Unal, Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Maltepe University. Professor Unal, it's great to see you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, on the eve of the second round, you forecast a relatively easy victory for President Erdogan, but the margin of that success is quite modest, short of 5%. What does it mean for the legitimacy of both the president and the electoral process? I mean, is it wide enough to give the president the confidence that he needs and narrow enough to ward off potential allegations of election fraud?
Well, if we look at the election results over the last almost two decades or so, this has been what we keep seeing. Basically, Erdogan won the previous presidential elections by a small margin again. I think he got it in the first round by a margin of 51.7% or something. So these margins in the Turkish election traditions are not terribly bad. So I wouldn't think there would be any cloud cast on the legitimacy of the elections. Indeed, the opposition has conceded defeat, and there has been quite a lively debate in the opposition circles as to what to do, whether the opposition leader should actually resign from his position, although he initially indicated that he would fight back.
Even though the opposition conceded the defeat, the leader of that opposition, Mr. Kılıçdaroğlu, pronounced these elections as one of the most unfair in recent years. Do you think the opposition may take it further and call its supporters onto the streets or take some other action?
We have a saying in Turkish, actually, it's just come to me. We say a wrestler who is defeated keeps asking for a new round. Okay, so that's quite understandable. I mean, he hasn't won anything since he basically took over the main opposition party. He's become almost Mr. Defeatist. But, you know, each time you would come up with some sort of an excuse for running into the next round. But I suppose this time it's going to be quite difficult for him to stand. If not impossible, because he seems to have used all his excuses. But at the same time, the people around himself, again, I keep reading about all that, keep advising him not to basically resign, but to keep fighting. But the Istanbul mayor, I think, is coming up for a fight. Mm-hmm. To get the leadership of the main opposition. So it's going to be an interesting period. But what I say is it's not basically just about the leader, but it is the leadership that counts, I think. For instance, okay, the main opposition leader, Kılıçdaroğlu, was quite a feeble person. You know, he wasn't strong enough to stand against Erdogan. You know, when he took over in 2010, I was also very enthusiastic about the prospective change in the government and all that. But all those hopes were dashed quickly because he didn't basically present any proper leadership.
Can I ask you a couple of questions about President Erdogan? Because his victory, notwithstanding the electorate, as you mentioned, actually, the electorate remains split across many lines, urban, rural, you know, secular, religious, and many others. Do you understand this split to be primarily domestically based, how Turkey is run, or is it more about Turkish positioning on the international stage?
Well, this time, I think the views, the opposition basically came up as to how to run Turkey, because the sort of proposals they came up with didn't appeal to the masses. I mean, imagine a situation. You have a leader who has been running the country for over two decades. I mean, he's basically, his popularity may have eroded, and there is widespread dissatisfaction with the way he runs the country, with the way he formulates policies, with the way he does things. Plus, you have an terrible economic crisis, much of which is because of the government's mishandling of the economy, presumably. Although the government has tidied up its house basically quite properly in the last 2 years and a half in terms of foreign policy, but in terms of handling the economy and the financial situation and all that, they seem to have made a lot of mistakes. And you can see this across the Turkish society. Wherever you go and talk to people, whoever you talk to, everybody is displeased and dissatisfied. But what the opposition came up with didn't seem to offer anything. Mm-hmm. You know, the old neoliberal policies, the old neoliberal financial begging for London marketeers, you know, to lend money to Turkey. But we have experienced all that, you know. And in terms of foreign policy, the criticism that the opposition came up with didn't certainly go well with the electorate in general.
Can I, before we go to foreign policy, one thing that interests me on the domestics, I have lots of Turkish friends, and most of them are, I have to say, are the urbanites, and they do criticize Erdogan government for the way public education is run, for the way economy is managed. And as you mentioned in many of your articles, the Erdogan government changed its tack on foreign policy. Do you think now that it has a renewed mandate, do you think it would be more amenable to the calls or to the dissatisfaction of that portion of the electorate that did not support him? Can he show the same flexibility on the domestic front?
From the first pronouncements he's been making, the fact that he's basically dismissed all the cabinet members, and he said, I think he would form a new cabinet. During the election campaign, he also sort of mentioned several times that some of the impediments, like the interviews, for instance, for the candidates seeking to seeking to take up a public job in the government sector would be all eliminated. So all this sounds well, but, you know, these are the public pronouncements. How is he going to basically handle some of the major problems over there remains to be seen. But as you pointed out, he certainly basically did quite a good job with the foreign policy over the last 2.5 years.
Now, speaking about oppositional tactics, you mentioned one inexplicable thing, you know, trying to, you know, associate Turkey with the neoliberal globalist policies at the time when much of the world is actually demonstrably moving away from it. That's quite difficult to understand. Now, all these pronouncements about NATO, given NATO's track record in predominantly Muslim countries, but as you understand, the Russians have our own bias, because I think the Russians generally are used to all things thrown their way, but I think it was absolutely pure astonishment in Moscow when Kılıçdaroğlu came out with accusations accusing Russia of electoral interference. And sure, this trick was used in the American context, but at least in the case of the United States, we could have seen the political utility of that. In this case, we are struggling to find it. Can you help us with that?
Well, I'm actually at a loss when it comes to the Twitter message he actually posted on that night. I just also posted a Twitter message saying that this is something incredible, unprecedented in Turkish political history, that an opposition leader coming up and accusing a major country
in a very very rude way. I have to say that the way it was phrased in Russian, it was very condescending. I mean, it was strictly like it was impolite. I know Turks, they're polite people, but this was very rude, just linguistic.
As I said, this was totally unprecedented. You know, we've never had something like that. Even if you are prime minister or the president, and then you have very credible intelligence pointing to something the Russians, to something the Russians are sort of.
And something like people voicing their support for President Erdogan. I mean, I know some Turks in Moscow who support Kılıçdaroğlu, some who support Erdogan. And by the way, Russian Turks voted in favor of the opposition, you know, according to the official tally. So, I mean,
I would imagine that, because the people, Turkish people I know of in Russia, you know, are quite, as you pointed out, prospective opposition voters. Yes. And they have freely expressed their choice. You know, what I was going to say was, even if you were running the country as prime minister, you know, the chief of the intelligence or the president, and then even if you have credible intelligence pointing at something, some sort of a mischief by Russia, by another country, I mean, there is a way of doing it. And we normally, even during the Cold War, for instance, the Germans used to mess up with their intelligence and the spy scandals, but the Turkish side used to manage it quite successfully, you know, through the behind
this
the curtain.
What diplomatic service is for, ultimately.
Totally. And the terminology and the wording was also interesting, because it wasn't something like a Turkish written message. It was something like
it was a Google Translate. I mean, if you actually check it, it was Google Translate. And, you know, that raises questions about the kind of experience and expertise he relies upon for making his foreign policy thinking.
Well, I mean, you said it. I was hesitant to come.
I checked it. It's Google Translate.
But basically, yes. It was as if written down in English, and the message was sent in English and then translated into Turkish, something like that. And I checked it with his previous messages, and it wasn't actually in line with his style either. Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically, I mean, he and all the spokespersons on foreign policy made remarks about foreign policy, the prospective foreign policy of Turkey. And none basically seem to have gone down well with the public in general.
Now, Professor Unal, what I'm sure will go down well with the public is us taking a very short break right now. But we will be back, I promise, in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
What is
to counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi, c'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Hassan Unal, professor of political science and international relations at Maltepe University. Now, Professor Unal, I heard you say in another interview that the fundamentals of the Turkish-Russian rapprochement are there. So regardless of the personality of the leader, he or she would most likely follow up on them. And this seems like an obvious point, but on the other hand, the fundamentals are not axiomatic. They depend on a particular worldview. And we in Russia long believed that the cornerstones of the functional Russian-German or Russian-EU relations were there. And look where it got us, which leads me to a question. What's the difference in your view between the way Turkey, under the current leadership, defines its national policy or national interest and the way it's done in the European Union?
I think what Turkey did over the last 2.5 years, roughly, is that it has adapted itself to the fast approaching multipolarity. I think I would also say that the election result in Turkey is also a triumph of multipolarity over unipolarity. Okay, so the main difference between the way Turkey basically formulates its foreign policy over the last few years and the way the Europeans do is that blindly support unipolarity, and they got carried away by the American by the American way of talking that Russia is going to be down on its knees because of the sanctions, and the Russian military is going to perform so badly, and because it's been badly run, because it's been mismanaged, and blah blah. But the Turkish side never basically took those utterances at their face value. And what I can see over the last few years, it's not just with Russia that Turkey has cultivated the best possible relations, but it has also created a new foreign policy by which, in a multifaceted and multidimensional way, multilateral way, you can actually look forward to establish and flourishing good relations with countries further in the way, like Central Asians, China, and others. The Europeans have become hostage of their worldview. Look at their top diplomat talking about a garden and the jungle. I mean, he must be living in a fool's paradise. I mean, I wish I knew what he's been on.
This is a very, very mild term. I would call it a racist or xenophobic paradise.
Well, apart from that, of course, there is that. There is that which is there, and then so many experts are going to basically bring that up. But what paradise? What garden and what jungle are you talking about? There are so many centers of civilizations, and there are so many centers of power. As you pointed out, I think you are following Foreign Minister His Excellency Lavrov in his African tour, and then you mentioned that, you know, the Turkish elections is being followed by African countries. I mean, so you have Turkey, which is in Africa. You have Turkey in Central Asia, in the Middle East, and elsewhere. What garden and what jungle are you talking about?
It's a very interesting framing because, as you mentioned, and it's not only under President Erdogan. I mean, I think Turkey throughout its history has been pretty multilateral in its approaches to its neighbors, to how it developed trade, to how it went about expanding itself. But if you look at the headlines in many of the Western media today, I saw one proclaiming that Putin won Turkish elections, another one stressing that there's growing despotism in Turkey, as if, you know, despotism could grow overnight. I mean, it's as if, you know, it's as if these people in this supposed European garden cannot even perceive the world as it is happening right now, because no one in the world would think about the fact that, you know, somebody dictates Turkish people their, you know, their choices, and yet the accusation is there, and many of the Europeans believe it firmly.
Well, let them carry on living on their planet, and let them carry on living in fool's paradise. You know, there isn't much we can do except that, like Turkey does, you know, in terms of trade and economic relations and a bit of political consultation and what have you. But we have learned how to deal with the Europeans. You know, they may say something. For instance, in NATO in NATO meetings where they praise Turkey to the sky, and in the next room when they get together in a European Union meeting, they basically criticize Turkey as if they are criticizing a you know, the worst possible country in the world.
Can I ask you about that, because I think this is a fascinating point, and this is something that distinguishes Turkey from other NATO members, because Turkey has practical hands-on experience of reconciling with its neighbors, including Russia. You know, if we think all the way back to 2015 and our difficulties over Syria, but this type of approach, this very practical approach to foreign policy, is quite different from the typical Western approach that is essentially about, you know, you have to submit to our will because you are a moral inferior. That's the only thing that they can essentially offer to other countries. I wonder if the Turkish liberals who lost the elections but who still remain a force in your country, if they would be willing to cooperate with the West on those terms, that, you know, accepting that their country somehow is not good enough, therefore it has to be benefited by the Western advice.
They talked about that for more than 10 years. And their main argument was about that. I used to call them chattering classes. You know, they would be chattering about how the Western world was so good, and then either you are within the European Union or you are basically in the third world. And then, you know, they would gasp with welfare and with the wealth of the West and all that. None was true at the time, but the Turkish, you know, chartering classes were like that. Many of them turned out, you know, later as it transpired, many of them were getting large funds from European Union foundations and what have you. I mean, but they have lost any little prestige they ever had with the Turkish public. You know, no one basically listens to what they say. And this is one of the things, perhaps I should have mentioned early in the interview, when I was talking about the main opposition acting hand in glove with the with some of the people that the Turkish public doesn't like, for instance, these guys, you know, Some of them came back into prominence again, thanks to the opposition.
You tweeted recently that coupled with the Ankara-Damascus normalization on the top of the Iran-Saudi reconciliation, the real Middle East spring is on the horizon, and you are contrasting it with the Arab spring of the past decade, in which I have to mention yet again, Turkey played on the side of the West. How do you think these two springs may be different now?
Well, the Arab Spring, as the West called it, you know, whenever there is something happening, any incident, any event in any part of the world which the West considers in its favor, it would be a spring. You can call it, for instance, a Prague Spring of 1968. You can have, you know, Middle East Spring, Arab Spring, and then there may be other springs if I sort of think about that. But what it is this time round, a real spring is actually coming, because there is spring is coming to the Middle East through out of its own dynamics. This is what we needed for so much. Yes, and look at the multipolarity, which is actually creating a wonderful atmosphere across the Middle East. I mean, the Saudis and the Iranians are coming to terms with each other over very serious issues, or over issues we used to be thought to think very serious, but now overnight they seem to have overcome all those issues. But we were sort of taught to believe that those issues would never basically go away. And for instance, just think about the American ascendancy in the Gulf. So you have the Iranian Shah, who was a very good friend of the Americans. And then you have the Arabs, led by Saudi Arabia. And again, very friendly to the United States. But the United States never tried to basically resolve their problems. They never even attempted that.
We only have a minute left, and I'm very tempted, since you brought up the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement, I'm very tempted to ask you about whether you think, given that the Turks have mended their relationship with many of their neighbors, do you think there is any chance of them reconciling with the Greeks, which potentially could have profound consequences, not only on the bilateral relationship, but also on the tensions between the West and non-West? And when I'm asking this question, I understand all the complications associated with it, but do you think President Erdogan, with his renewed mandate, would be tempted by something like this? Because in this case, he would really make history.
Not so much by Erdogan, but a new attempt may come from the Greek side, because they are following what has been happening across the world, as well as the region-wide. Because multipolarity means the decreasing influence of the West, and the rise of Turkey in the region in every way possible. And then what are you going to do with Turkey? I mean, can you simply sort of think that the Western world is going to protect you from the Turks? Well,
Turkey and NATO, that would be pretty hard, although wow, pretty amusing to watch for, especially.
So, basically, since Turkey has basically made up with all its neighbors, including Israel, Egypt, and others in the region, the Greeks have been basically having second thought about the policy, aggressive policies they have been pursuing towards Turkey. So it may come at some stage, but it would certainly take time, because I somehow know the Greek mind. So it is a hard nut to crack. It's not easy.
Well, Professor, now if or when it comes, I hope we can discuss it on the show.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you very much for your time this time around. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.
We'll be right back.